Now on Do Radio, Tomorrow's World with John Kay.
Hello, I'm your host, John Kay, and today on Tomorrow's World, I'm joined by Stuart McKenna, Managing Director, and Russell Hall, Technical Director of SEPA, an immersive experience design studio blending technology, storytelling, and live interaction. SEPA has been designing immersive experiences long before the buzzword existed, shaping everything from Alton Towers queues to cutting-edge cultural installations. We'll dive into how they create awe and wonder, their words not mine, crafting journeys that begin weeks before visitors arrive and extend beyond the moment itself. Stuart and Russell share insights on blending tech with storytelling, recruiting curious talent, and navigating emerging tools like AI responsibly, all while keeping technology invisible so the magic shines through. If you've ever been intrigued by immersive rides or wondered how tech enriches real-world experiences, you're in for a treat. Let's dive in.
Organization with labels on it that some people go beyond.
No, there's some cable management Instagram posts which I've definitely favorited. Don't worry, I have a label printer myself. Obviously, this. I'm stage one amateur, but you know, I'm getting there. Anyway, I'm sure our listeners are fascinated by this conversation. Let me start by thanking you for joining us on Tomorrow's World on Do Radio. I know you don't really know what you're letting yourself in for, but it's just a chat, right? You've got the most amazing business. You do the most amazing things. And I'm sure our listeners probably don't know much about that. And I'd love to let them into your world because you've got a fantastic website. And I'm definitely going to put that in the show notes. So if I forget, it's SEPA.com. And it is amazing. What's the initial? I've got it up. The initial strapline: awe and wonder. Is that the first thing people see? I mean, what a claim! Go on, we got to start there. Like, who's come up with the goal when you first go to the website is to inspire awe and wonder? I think that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Evan Grant, our founder, has to take all the credit for that. I mean, he's been running. He started SEPA. 27 years ago on, I think he started the business whilst at university in Bournemouth. And Awe and Wonder is a proposition that I think has just like followed the company through the years, right? And it's quite a nice sentiment. I think it's a universal feeling. I think if you're 5 years old or you're 65 years old, you can still endeavor to feel sort of awe and wonder. You kind of get that when you see something for the first time and you're not entirely sure how it's been made, right? So it feels a little bit like magic. So that's definitely something that we pegged on our website for a long time. And yeah, Evan has a large part to play with that.
Well, I think it's fantastic. I think more companies should aim high. But let's take a little bit of a step back. Before we get into tech and your tech history and the tech time machine, which we are going to talk about, because I'd love to get to know you both a bit better. Do you want to tell the listeners what SEPA is, what it does, how it got to where it is now? Because obviously you don't start by doing the kind of things that you're currently doing today. And there's an evolution, but in case people haven't heard of it and what like an immersive experience is or what kinds of things that you do, just give us a bit of history if you wouldn't mind, Stuart.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the really short version is we're an experience design studio, and we do a lot of work in what people now know as the immersive space. We've been doing immersive for a very long time before it was a popular term. But it's more about experiences that you can see and feel and touch in the real world rather than just in a browser in 1920, 1080. So these are things that you can go and see and visit, hopefully create some memories, create some awe and wonder. And SEPA has a long history in themed attractions, so themed entertainment. I've done a large history in work of has been seen at Alton Towers, Shrek London on the South Bank, you know, built 10 years ago, still featured in Time Out today as one of the destinations to go and see. So a real heritage in themed entertainment, spectacles around projection mapping. So, you know, doing light and audio visual on projection onto the side of large buildings, did a lot of pioneering work in that space, you know, a good 10 years ago. the world's changed, right? And we now have a whole plethora of new tools that are available to us, and we don't just do that anymore. We do a whole raft of stuff. So we do work in permanent installations, so cultural installations, museums, galleries. We will do entertainment spaces. We will do brand experiences that are temporary in nature, so very, you know, sort of marketing experiential space. But we work with, and really proud to have worked with, some of the biggest companies across the world. And Evan has just, you know, done an amazing job in creating a really great and diverse portfolio and keeping the company running over 20 years, when I know a lot of companies haven't sort of stayed the course, right? So, I mean, I've literally been with the company a couple of years, but I'm standing on big shoulders, because we've had a brilliant last two decades of business. So yeah, a really exciting time, and really excited about the future of what creative technology looks like for us as a company.
Yeah. So you really mentioned a blast from my past there, Alton Towers. So I grew up in the Northwest. So it wasn't right next to Alton Towers, but Alton Towers is a theme park, in case people don't know what it is, you know, rides and roller coasters and things. It used to be the big summer treat for me to go. It used to take us about an hour and a half, and then probably about 2 hours of bloody queuing to get into the car park, because it was unbelievably popular. So that is kind of bringing those things to life. That was the original spark, was it? So you don't just go and like queue for a roller coaster or whatever it may be. There's a story, isn't there? It's really interesting just to get that kind of, I know you weren't there at the start, Stuart, but just that kind of feeling. So you were there to try and bring that kind of dead time almost, or lead time to life, so that people have a story. It's not just about 20 seconds of G-force and adrenaline, right? That's amazing.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it is all about story, narrative, content. We over the last couple of years we're now full service. So we were very much in the pure technology space. And then we've just become more and more involved in developing the stories, developing the concepts, taking the brief from the client, and then executing across all of the facets of the production journey. But yeah, our experiences start from in the themed entertainment space. From the moment that you enter that queue, we want to take you into a world that you've not been to before, and you need to keep that person in make-believe land, right? So then we've got them for a short period of time. So we use a whole raft of different techniques in order to keep them in that world before we release them out the other side.
Yeah, amazing. I think, would it be useful to pick a more recent one that you've worked on in the last couple of years, or both of you've worked on? Just, I think it'd be interesting to understand the process, because I think, as you said, sorry, I mean the process from a client comes to you and says, we've got this idea for X, Y, and Z. It'd just be, because I think, well, I've obviously gone through your website. I think what's apparent is, for a start, everyone just talks about an immersive experience or being immersed in things these days. You seem to have been doing it a long time, and it'd be nice to get behind that kind of word that you said, Stuart. It's a bit of a buzzword these days, trying to get people off screen and experiencing things. Just like one of your, I don't know, installations or something that you've done in the last couple of years where the client comes to you, what do you do to use your team to build the story, and then actually how the tech and, you know, hopefully the tech then disappears behind the scenes and actually just becomes a user experience, or a user is an awful word as well for an immersive experience. You know, the actual experience of the individual going to this event or whatever it may be. I think that'd be really useful just to get behind the scenes to see how you approach these things.
Oh, I wonder if I were to jump in on that. I think this is where it's the best job in the world, really, because you get to play in a sandpit all the time of ideas, where brands are coming to us and they're needing to connect to their audiences in a more meaningful way than a website. Not often do they know how, so they lean on us quite a lot around how do we go and create a, I mean, it's more than a user experience. a visitor experience? I mean, how do you actually start it before you even leave the house? How do you start it weeks, months before you even turn up to the physical place? And really at the center of all of it is joy. So like the trigger that we're after is that kind of dopamine of joy that we get to release in a good way. Not the way that you kind of get through a doom scrolling, but the one that you go on a roller coaster and you go, okay, that's I'm going to go back and do it again and actually get a euphoria. So you've got to get into these wonderful world of, well, how do you get from nothing to something? So how do you innovate? How do you come up with the ideas, the concepts, go through a process that can't be rigid? There's got to be some flexibility to it. So really it's right at the, and there's multiple stages to it. So there's maybe a proactive way that we're always working in the R&D side of things, that we're always coming up with things that clients have never even thought about before, which is different to a client coming to with us but with an idea. Because sometimes we'd go, that's a brilliant idea, client, but how about this? And they'd go, oh my goodness, I haven't even thought about that. And that's a real buzz. So you've got the push and the proactive R&D approach, which I think we're really good at, tinkering, playing with things, getting together, and just experimenting. And I think this is where curiosity is like the key thing that anyone that we would look to work with Zeepa is that bug of curiosity of like, yeah, look underneath that and find out a little bit more and just keep, you know, pulling at a thread, and it leads you to some magical places. So you kind of got the ideation side of things that we come up with and push versus the client brief. Maybe they're opening a park or a physical installation. Often they've got a brand that they want to go and immerse somebody in. So it comes with quite a structured story sometimes. So here's our brand, but we've only ever expressed it on a web page. Like, how do we go and bring that to life? So then we kind of kick off a creative process where we've got a very talented creative director that would go and say, well, how do we turn your brand into a physical visitor experience? And that's when we start triggering senses. So we kind of go, well, what senses can we go and use with this to go and get your touch, your sense, your sight, your smell, your taste? And it gets really fun when we go through all of those, maybe tissue sessions with the client to kind of say, well, what resonates with you most? Like, what do you want to put your client, your audience through? And your audience might be employees. It might be board experiences. It might be consumer experiences. So it changes quite often with the target audience. So this is where the insights part of the business would come in around, well, who are we doing it for? And we'd be really good to get into the shoes of the people.
I guess I'd always assumed it was for the consumer. That's not always the case.
No. So anytime somebody, it's about communication, really. Not always. So you've got the consumer side, maybe a theme park, but ultimately a brand needs to be communicated. Quite often, can we move into the investor world, maybe, which is a bit more corporate? We don't do it often, but that can happen. But it's essentially a message that we're getting people immersed in. So it's a thing that can take many different shapes. So obviously I think Alton Towers is a really good example that everybody can relate with.
Yeah.
But we can take that and turn it into all manner of brand experiences that we bring to life.
And how do you get into this kind of world? Like, what skill set is your team, your people?
Very diverse, I would say, which is amazing to turn up to work and have so many different conversations with so many different people coming from so many different angles. You've got, and I always kind of associate it with, have you ever got to the end of a 3D film and you've seen all the credits of all the people that are doing something in a 3D film? Have you ever noticed how many people there are? And you've got all of these roles and titles, and it's like there's a similarity to the physical world as well, where we've got lighting, we've got audio, we've got, you know, special effects, we've got hardware, we've got just a huge diverse skill set that can bring a physical digital thing to life. About the core of it, curiosity. I'd say that curiosity is the key to, but it's very different across the disciplines. I'm not sure if Stu's got anything to add, maybe about the different types of people from, just picking on, you've got your creative discipline, you've got your, and then creative can split multiple ways into like visualization, into 3D. You've got your animation, you've got your content creation. So this is all the way, the spectrum of like coming up with ideas to then coming up with the content that could be real-time 3D, it could be high-quality 3D renders, it could be motion video, it could be going on LED screens, it could be going on projection, projector mapping. You've got your developers and your whole spectrum of developers, from your front-end developers to your back-end developers to your hardware developers. You got your hardware people that will be working across LED installations, again, getting to projection mapping, getting into huge infrastructure, going on site and getting it wired in, plumbed in, working, resilient, like, you know, disaster like proof for certain things. Lighting, which gets magical with lighting to go and create all of that kind of theater. Audio, like audio should never be like, audio is such a powerful thing. So yeah, yeah. It goes on.
Well, I certainly agree with that. Can I just pick on one thing you said? You mentioned the word curiosity. That's a big buzzword for me, like as a parent, frankly, as a, like people are always talking these days about what the hell do we tell our kids about the future of work? And adaptability and curiosity are the things that I try and get them to drum into. Sorry, that's what I try and drum into my children, because who knows what's going to happen. Like when you're recruiting, Stuart, like how do you recruit for curiosity?
That's a big question. I guess it depends in the field that you're recruiting for, right? And the number of disciplines that Russell talks about, they make it sound like it's incredibly hard to find all of those people. Yeah. Actually, it's not, right? The industry is not that big, and everybody has either worked with or knows someone. And the last 18 months, we've just been building out this team. Feel really fortunate to be able to do that, of people that we really want in the company, and that's come through referrals or history or experience. And I guess curiosity might be something that's prevalent in all of those people that I think are now the full-time employees in SEPA. I am genuinely surprised with the amount of talent that we have and in the conversations that we have in our meetings, because it goes way beyond my capability, and that's a good thing, right? When a group of people are greater than some of the parts, and you know, you can arrive at a point that is, you know, you wouldn't get there alone. That's when it becomes really, really interesting. So I'll take the curiosity from the creative director, the curiosity from the technical directors, and then the production teams who want to move stuff on massively. And if you put all of that together in some kind of melding pot, then you arrive in some special place. The point around recruiting for that, we try and bring in junior talent. So we go to some of the grad shows, and we do a lot of work with UAL. We've gone in and done some portfolio reviews just to help them, the next generation of students, get their leg up into the industry, because it's incredibly difficult, right?
Yeah.
The world is changing. Employment rates are dropping for graduates. You know, they're coming out with sizable debt. So the future that I had when I was their age is really different to what it is today and, you know, next year. So we'll try and find and identify the right people who can, you know, we think have got that spark. And it doesn't necessarily just mean it's all about the highest level of craft and capability. Like the drive and the enthusiasm of the individual, I think, is as important, because all of those skills can all be learned and taught over the years of being in a studio. So I think it's as much about curiosity as about you really want to have a go at learning and getting better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So just one of the things that struck me is that this isn't necessarily directly your problem or your issue, but in the world that people are getting, you know, more and more on their screens and more almost disconnected with other humans and meeting other humans. And lots of stats around increasing loneliness, and people are just, you know, being, disconnected is, I think, probably the best word. How are you tackling that kind of enticing people to your installations? Now, I know it's almost like your customers want people to go, but they're doing it through you. But how are things changing, I guess, is my question, over the last 5 or 10 years, where we've got increasing technology, we've got increasing dopamine hits in other ways, which I think you touched on Russell. Are people still interested and intrigued by going and visiting a physical installation, ride, museum, whatever it may be? That must be getting harder, right?
I'm we're seeing a huge amount of experiences popping up, running around the world, but also London. I mean, tomorrow, then we're going to the David Bowie experience tomorrow, for instance, in Lightrooms. There's a an explosion of it, and I think we've been kind of riding this wave our careers, and it's kind of come from quite a niche area, but now it's going more mainstream, and it's wonderful to see. And it's only going to go and push the whole area more. I think there's a lot more investment in the area. I think there's a lot of private equity coming in, which is always a good sign to go and say that they're going to go and get a return, which means that there's an audience for it. So yeah, it's a curve that's getting stronger, harder, quicker, and more competitive. So I think it's a good thing.
Agreed. And we're doing a lot of work out in the Middle East at the moment, they're sort of cultural and entertainment destinations, and which haven't really existed in the region before. So I was out last month, and some people were getting an exclusive tour of what's been made before it's open to the general public. And I got more kick out of people's reactions than the actual completion of the work, right? That they were just genuinely amazed. This sort of awe and wonder, you kind of saw it there in people's faces, both young and old. So I think in those regions that haven't had it before, like, they cannot get enough. But I think in the UK and Europe and in places where we're more used to it, a really smart shared experience is the way forward. It isn't about, you know, VR solo, put a headset on and escape from the world. Seeing things for the first time with others, I think, is where the next trend is going.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I was almost hoping that was your answer. Like, because from our point of view, we've started a radio station in 2025, which was the only UK radio station to be launched in 2025, because nobody listens to the radio anymore. But our view is that people are craving this kind of belonging, this feeling of interacting with other humans. And one of the reasons we do it as a radio station is that if I am listening to a show at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning, I know that I am having the same experience as lots and lots of other people, even if they may not be right next to me. And actually, that's something that we're moving towards, to try and launch these listening parties. You know, like in the olden days, bands would have a listening party for a new vinyl that came out. Well, we're starting the process of having listening parties where people collect together and listen to a radio show. So not on their phones, in silence for an hour. I've been to a few, and it's quite an experience. It's something that you don't do these days. So I think you're right. I think I'm loving the fact that people are craving that, you know, getting out of the house, experiencing something with other people. And I can totally understand that, seeing that, well, you call it awe and wonder, seeing the lights go on in someone's mm-hmm. face, and that surprise and delight must be, yeah, the biggest reward, you know, other than, you know, cable management, which must be, you know, probably a close second. And in terms of, like, one of the things that we struggle with, and I wonder if you have put some thought into this, is that, can you get a bit more longevity out of an event? So you talked about the journey sort of, and that I was intrigued by that, the journey sort of weeks or months before people actually go, maybe to Alton Towers or whatever it is, or the Bowie event. Can you get a sense that people are, yeah, this, I use the word belonging. So rather than it being a spectacle that they go and enjoy and leave, is there a way of having a bit more before and after, where people feel part of this? You know, oh wow, I went to the Bowie experience in 2026, or have you been to this new ride? And is that something that is coming, or is that harder to achieve? I don't know who wants to answer that. Sorry.
I think it's the most. It's a very powerful space. Like the phrase is, you know, it's about the journey, not the destination. Right? You know, which is a bit difficult to say because we're creating destinations, but like,
exactly.
The anticipation to the event is a wonderful space to play around with creatively, around how you can get people collaborating around what are they going to do there. You can go and get them ready for it. You can go and maybe assign them characters. You can go and get them creating something that
that propels their experience on the day. So yeah, so there's this whole conversation you can facilitate on the lead up to it that's always wonderful to unlock, all the way down to queue management and even queuetainment. So even just before the experience as well. So I know this is what you were quite saying, but like the just waiting in a queue, and how do you go and make that more fun? And how do you go and make that increase the anticipation is something to really unlock. Mm-hmm. And after you've done the experience, how do you go and share it with your friends? So maybe your friends weren't there with you. How do you go and tell them about it in a way that they don't just get broadcasted at? And go, oh, I did this thing. It's how do you go and involve them in the output of it? And how do you go and create, hopefully, them to come back in again together as a pair or a family? So yeah, so the bookends of an experience, I think, are really as important as the experience.
Yeah. Given that this is a technology show, I'd love to hear a bit about how technology has changed or is changing your business. We'll talk about your past in a minute, and I know I've asked you some specific questions, but just in terms of SEPA, obviously there's so much change in the world of tech these days, from VR and the wonderful metaverse, which I'm sure you dive straight into. But you know, AI, and you talked about having coders and software people as part of the team. Like, all of this stuff seems very up in the air. I don't want to just talk about AI, but just technology generally. How are you as a business and a group of people trying to embrace it? Because obviously you use a lot of technology, but also like manage the human side of people worried about jobs and, you know, how is all that going, Stuart? Like, that must be a tricky management tightrope.
Big question. I guess without saying cliches, the kind of technology side we try to make invisible, right? Because we kind of know what we're doing in that space. So we don't really present the full technology solution to the clients. It's more about what's the problem, what's the solution, how do we create something that's going to be really sticky, and then we kind of know what will be the right technology stack to sort of answer all of those solutions that we kind of put forwards. The kind of technology that we are using, has it changed that much over the last 10 years? I mean, we're in the audio, visual, light and sound, which, you know, that has all, it's all growing up, it's all maturing. There's more technology, hardware that's become cheaper. So we more powerful machines that we can use, but we're still ultimately creating display technology that you can kind of go and see. I'll let Russell talk to the software, because he's knee deep in what we're doing from a software and code creation perspective. But like we're working on a project at the moment in Sunderland, and it's called Culture House, and it's a public building, a huge amount of public investment, and we've worked hand in hand with the architects to bring this building to life, to give it a soul and to give it a personality. And the atrium is a big cavernous four-leveled space it's wrapped in LED, and it will be the biggest LED atrium in Europe. Wow. It's absolutely brilliant. And so now, because of the declining cost in LED and the performance upgrades, we can now afford to do something like that for a public building. And the content that's been created on it, which is waterfall sequences and nature, will be something that I've not really, really seen before. And the content creation for that, we've leaned heavily into generative just to help us be as efficient as we can with, you know, with the public money. Because there isn't very much time for it. All of that technology that sits in that building should feel invisible, because we're going to have community groups that will be sitting in there reading. It's a public library. They don't need it to feel like it's a technology showcase. The technology needs to be an extension of the fabric of the building. So that's kind of what we're learning, is like, technology's evolving, but we're just trying to make it invisible and hide it into the environments.
Yeah.
I think, there's two points I was going to make here. One about this explosion of multiple different types of technology that's happened over the past 20 years, maybe. And I think it's kind of plateauing. And the challenge is now, how do you go and make something amazing out of this kind of primordial soup of all of this stuff, which is, again, our challenge that we need to go and do. And then we've got the software side that the two key, and obviously there's a huge amount of stuff that's always going on software, but the two is to highlight is ethics and data privacy. You're going to go, and then the responsibility we have around the visitor around those two things. So you're going to get into the, just because you can doesn't mean you should kind of space with, well, how are you going to do something with AI? And you've kind of, sometimes you've got a pressure to use it, and you kind of go, well, ethics and privacy. So you kind of go, well, it's for the customer, it's for the visitor that we always have to kind of put first. So those two spaces are evolving. One is maturing quite well, I'd say, around data privacy, and people are taking it a lot more seriously, certainly from brands' perspectives. And then ethics is a new space. Not actually, it's not a new space, but it's a growing space of importance and awareness. And what does it mean to have responsible AI? And that's quite embryonic, I'd say.
I would certainly agree with that.
Something that we take quite seriously. And again, that comes down to us tinkering and playing and kind of going, well, what is the responsible way of implementing AI? And there are so many facets to it. So many. I mean, I could go into some, but that's a rabbit hole. Because you've got it for how to use it in the experience, how to use it as a tool to go and create content, how do you go and create it as a tool that in the admin area of the businesses is essentially, there's it applies to absolutely everything. So it's ethics across the whole lot, I'd say, is that you could do a whole show on it, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. It's nice that you almost, you must use a lot of technology, but it's almost like you talk about it in an old-fashioned way, which I kind of like, actually. Like, it's, you don't really care, frankly. It's almost tech ambivalent. Yeah. Like, it's the output, it's the ambience, the joy, and wonder. I know you said tech invisible.
It's just a tool. But
it's the experience, isn't it? It is an experience business that you're in, and it's what the customer gets out of it rather than what you put in. Yeah, I do like that.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think some people over-index on the technology, and there's a lot of buzz in certain areas to kind of use it, and it is useful sometimes if there's a new bit of tech out and there's a bit of PR splash to go and do. Sort of like, how do you use a new bit of tech? You know, you kind of got AR glasses that are hitting the market in a big way this year. But it's different from rolling out a robust infrastructure that will last years. We kind of have this term of a legacy project, that you can't deliver something to Alton Towers or Culture House that's just a pop-up, a tentpole kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you've got to be quite serious with what you use. But then, if it is just a temporary thing, then we can have some fun with some experimental tech that's quite new on the market and just play around.
Yeah. Very interesting. Right, I am going to now take you back into your past. I'd love to know a bit more about you outside of SIPA. So the question that I ask initially is a bit of tech from your past that really made an impact, whether this is as a kid, a teenager, starting out in career, but something from a while ago. Stuart, what would you say?
I'm old, right? So I was at uni in the 90s, studying fine art at Liverpool. My old world was painting, paint canvas, making a mess. That was everything, really. And then in the second year, so we're talking 95, 96, that's how old I am, Photoshop 3, one of the teachers got really involved in Photoshop and had a computer, one computer in the studio, and I just fell in love with it. I was just, oh my God. Version 3 is when they introduced layers for the first time. So you could build up artworks on top of one another. So then I was at this junction of like, well, I love all this physical painting, but there's this software thing. And that's when I sort of just went all in on software. So my final exhibition was painting, but then scanned in, and then brought into Photoshop, and then manipulated and then printed back out again, and that was the sort of final exhibition, and then that was it. Then on leaving university, I was like, right, well, I am not equipped for the working world. I have no skills other than painting and a little bit of Photoshop. So I sent myself off to night school for 12 months while working at Burger King, because I knew that's what I wanted to do. And luckily, some guy who ran a small studio on them gave me a leg up and helped me get in. train me over 2 or 3 years. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here at Seeker, is try and find those people that have got that little thing and then help them make that leap. So yeah, Photoshop 1995 was my turning point.
Oh, no, I love that. And look, don't apologize about being old. I was at uni before you, so you're in good company here. Hey, look, when I started work, which was I started in 95, so I was just a bit ahead of you. Like, we didn't have computers at work. Nobody had a computer. Like, can you imagine that? I used to do things with pen and paper, like calculations, literally sums and long division on a bit of bloody paper. And then they phased in computers in about my second year, and they were these enormous heavy things where you needed to go to the gym just to lug them about four or five bloody kilos of this thing, lugging them out to clients. So yeah, no, you don't need to apologize about that. Handwritten essays, handwritten work, no mobile phones. Yeah, god, they were the days. No, I refuse to talk about the past with such nostalgia, but I do remember it well. Russell, you look a little bit younger than us. So
going to make that point. I was like, yes, get in there.
This is the radio. Nobody can see how old I look.
Out of uni I think 2006.
You're just showing off now.
Yeah, I was going to get there. I actually think all of us have grown. I mean, I think we've all got kids, I believe, over John before. They have no idea what the world was like before the internet. I grew up on the absolute cusp of before and after. Like, it came through. I had the first version of the internet, and it gave me the bug. It gave me oh my goodness, the power of this. I always remember when Ask Jeeves came in high school, and I was so amazed by this potential, but it was rubbish. Like, it was awful. It's like, oh, it's this thing that can, you know, it tells you everything. And it doesn't. And this was when you were, but it was better than the Encarta CD-ROM that I was using. But anyway, that was, I think that the wave that they're kind of going through was really, really cool. To get to the point where I went, I know I want to go and do some stuff with technology. We didn't quite know what. Went through, school, college, uni. I did a multimedia degree, and I kind of got exposed to real-time 3D, coding, fine art, loads of modules, and it was just a smorgasbord. Within that, I found Macromedia Flash, and it is something that was the catalyst, I believe, to my whole career, because it was this breeding ground of where art meets technology, where coders and artists were like put together in the same design package. And it was just this, I ended up becoming a Flash developer on my first gig outside of uni. And I'm not sure if people know what Flash is, but it was like the version of the web before JavaScript came along, and all of the websites that we see today. So Steve Jobs ended up killing Flash because he was like, this isn't what the world needs. But it was that breeding ground of creativity before. And as I said, it was this kind of the power of getting an artist and a developer to sit together in the same package and come up with a game. You could come up with a website. You could come up with something that interfaced with some hardware that we did. It was this one software package that just had tentacles into everything. So I'd say that's the thing that I would say was my root kind of like light bulb moment going off.
Yeah. So funny you should say Ask Jeeves. That came up in conversation across our dinner table with the kids the other day, because obviously right. They've got no idea what it is. Yeah. And we then looked it up to see whether it still exists or it's still. Yeah. And so you can go and find it. And it only stopped working literally about a year ago, I think. I forget the exact date, but if you look it up, it was still active and you could still use it until about a year ago, even though nobody's probably used it for literally 20 years. So no, very interesting. By the way, my answer to this question is the BBC microcomputer. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And I used to code on it in, I think it was BASIC, it was called back then. Like, there was no JavaScript or anything else. And I used to make my little like one screen games and play them with my mates and be amazed that you could actually press a key and a character that you designed would move across the screen. So now I remember those days well. I never went into coding, but I was always fascinated by computers and what you could do with them.
Nice.
Good answers, both of you. Right, we now need to move on to the present day. And what kind of bit of tech today has made a big impact? Maybe not today, maybe the last few years. And if you can avoid saying your MacBook or your iPhone, that would be wonderful. Russell. Stuart. Let's keep the same order.
Russell, you go first while I think of an answer, mate.
Go on then, Russell.
So, I think, from my perspective, it's not, and I've kind of mentioned this already, it's not one technology. There are so many out there, and kind of having ridden this wave and even getting quite overwhelmed in certain points and going, oh my goodness, in my role, how do I keep up with everything? In the last few years, there's a new area that's kind of been hardening around orchestration layers. And it might be a completely new thing to people, but it's essentially a piece of technology that's able to go and sit on top of loads of other technologies, like an octopus with lots of tentacles into capabilities. And then you're able to control it from one area. And an example would be, some people might be familiar with, I've forgotten the name of another one I was trying to remember, but NAN is something that I've been using.
That's come up on another show, NAN. I have played with it a little bit. I am no, by no means an expert, but.
So it's probably maybe a bit daunting to start with, but it's much better a solution than having 100 different other pieces of tech all doing their own different thing. But if you were to go and have this orchestration layer across the top and then talk to the orchestration layer, you can make your business way more streamlined. You can make your visitor experience way more streamlined. And not only is it about streamlining, but it's also about exposing what has been traditionally a back of house technology thing. Oh, that's the developers going to do that, and you can't see the code. It exposes the code. It goes and puts what developers have created into little visual blocks that non-coders can come in and just wire stuff up. Yeah. And you can actually see entire systems visually and be a non-technical person contributing, or be it verbally, or communicating what you want or what you don't want from what you're seeing, to actually, I've been getting involved with people who have no idea about code, being able to go and code by moving blocks of or nodes around within this orchestration system. So I think there's a huge power in that that kind of just simplifies the complex. That's where my mind goes of a piece of technology that's got a huge amount of impact, from my perspective.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would say, having played with it, NAN is still a bit clunky for a non-coder. Sorry to talk over you. So professional. I can see how it could be, and we must be getting there. But, you know, just being able to say, this is what I would like to achieve. Normally, I'd have to write a bit of code to go and talk to this bit of code, to go and talk to this program, to do this thing. But you then, it's almost in non-coding language, you say, I would like I would like this bit of software to go and get this bit of information, and then to produce it in this way and to send it out to these people. You have these kind of blocks. I don't think we're quite there yet. I think you still need a bit of coding kind of nous.
If you wire Claude up to it in a way,
right,
you don't have to do any node linking or configuration. You actually just tell Claude to go and create your orchestration layer that then creates its tentacles out to its thing. So there's a...
Okay, maybe I'll try that next, because I do use a bit of Claude code and co-work occasionally. So yeah, I do like that. Okay, interesting.
Right. There's a bit of a barrier, but it's only going to go and decrease. So
yeah, it's
for low code platforms, maybe if we're to summarize it, that I think lots of people should start getting a bit more curious about, because that can enable them.
Yeah, I agree. I tell lots of people about Lovable and Replit and NATN and Taught Code if you want to. These kind of things, I think you can start to do things which you would never believe are possible, like bang up a homepage or a website, which I know is not, you know, particularly useful these days. But if you can't do it, the fact that you can do it now within literally probably 15, 20 minutes is pretty amazing. It gives you that wow and awe and wonder. Sorry, I was combining your two words. right, Stuart, have we given you long enough to think of an answer?
I think mine's a bit more obvious. I think it would be this sort of video call technology, like post-COVID, you know, we've now adopted, you know, the call that we're having today It has transformed the way that we do business. We're proudly hybrid. We have a little office in Old Street, which we go in once or twice a week. But, you know, we work very comfortably and very efficiently with this technology. It didn't really exist not too many years ago. And it has transformed the way that we work with teams all across the world. I feel like I don't just have to work with people in the same time zone. Well, they can collaborate from any country internationally on some of the biggest projects because I can see them, and you know, it feels like it's not perfect, but it is as good as it kind of can be. So I think just, yeah, video call technology has absolutely revolutionized the way that we as a company do business. And but what we are now seeing is we all need to spend more time together, and that we are now actually coming to the office much more as a group of individuals, but then as an extension of our team and projects, then yeah, it's invaluable.
Yeah, it is amazing. It hasn't been that long, actually, since it's been super reliable. Like this technology, we've got just three of us in three different places, yeah, having a pretty easy conversation, actually. Like, as you said, the technology is invisible, right? We're just having a chat. I can see you. I can see your facial reactions, as I would be if we were sat in the pub. It's not as good as being sat in the pub, I'd have to say. But, you know, maybe we'll do that at some point in the future. Talking of the future, let's move on. Right, Russell, you're up again. So the question was a bit of tech that either you hope will exist in the future or you're worried might exist in the future.
I think mine goes, it treads that line between I hope it exists in a responsible way because it could be, it's got the potential to get a bit weird. I love bringing the future to life today. Like it's one of the things that we have the ability to do because we can use all manner of things that don't need to be on the consumer market, and we can put it in a physical space and go, like, this is what you could be doing in 5-10 years time. To be able to do that, we like to simulate what it could be like, because we can simulate certain features. We can simulate a visitor experience. We can simulate all manner of things, I suppose, where the world of visualization goes. And this is where spatial computing also goes as well, right? So where does the world of spatial computing go? But the ability to simulate it. So how do we do responsible simulation of the future to go and help us make better decisions today? So there's a huge amount of tools today that does it, but it's with the advent of AI, and the ability to go and create an AI image that we might all be used to going to some AI program and go, make me an image. You can go and make, minimum you need is 12 of them a second to go and make a video. So you can go and have a real-time AI-generated video of whatever you can visualize the future to be. That's a huge amount of power to work out how to use that correctly. So that is, as I said, it can be used for all manner of things, but how do we use it responsibly? I suppose it's my.
Yeah. No, I've had discussions about something similar, I guess, on this show about the fact that some of the tech is getting so good that the line between reality and artificial generation is very quickly going to become indistinguishable. And how do we, you know, in a world where, people are already lying about reality, including presidents of this world. You know, if they have the ability to create images that nobody can tell, you know, I think that's quite scary.
It's that one step further, because I think we're already there with the images that no one can tell. It's the real-time video being generated live, of all those images together with audio that's coming out of it that can either be amazing or terrifying.
Yeah. No, I was speaking to a guy who works in, what's he call it? Forensic. He was an expert witness in the courts about technology. I can't remember exactly, forensic auditing or something, which it sounds boring, but actually what he does is super interesting. Right. And he was saying, you know, the days of video evidence in courts are coming to an end. Because unless there's some sort of regulation about some sort of code that you have to, by law, stick into AI-generated video, then you know, it's no longer enough to say this guy was caught on camera stealing this car, because we don't actually know whether he was or whether somebody just decided to make it look like he was. So he was pretty worried about that.
Yeah, it's that's a genuinely big problem, that, isn't it? Where all CCTV cameras are now void. There's actually a BBC drama on that called The Capture.
I've seen that actually. That's because that's live as well, isn't it? So that's real-time CCTV manipulation, where the police are looking at something and they're like, well, it didn't really happen, but they don't know, or at least back, you know. Yes, oh my God, that is pretty scary. That's a great program, by the way. I thought that was really well done.
It is. But, you know, so there's the scary side, but how do we go and use it to make better decisions, right? So if you had the ability to jump into the future and then kind of go, oh, this isn't as good as it could be, and come back to the present and go, oh, well, let's go and advise our brand to go and do X, Y, and Z, because we've just, in our instance, you know, we've simulated what their brand experience could be, and we've simulated all of the different user experiences and the visitor journey. So there's a brilliant side to it. And we can save money, and we can go and make sure we hit that kind of joy moment that we were talking about. So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I like that spin. Stuart, how about you?
Similar to Rustin, I guess. The thing that we're wrestling with is a lot of the live experiences that we do are pretty linear, right? We create a piece of content, has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that has to change, right? We really want to put our visitors into like a sort of a unique experience for them, so everything feels like they're the hero in their own story. Using real-time technology to create something that will change over time based on that individual's input, and whether we can read stuff off their physical self, how they're feeling, but then also their emotional state as well, could adapt and change that environment. So right, we've started doing some tests in this area, but it's got some real big leaps to take, right? But I'm really excited where we're going to end up in the next 5 years. I mean, I've just seen how much leaps we've made over the last couple, and you talked about the fidelity of the image in the video now being indistinguishable. Like, I just know that this is coming, that these sort of live experiences will be curated for one, or it will feel like it's your own personal story where you're the hero. So yeah, that's what I'm really, really excited about.
Yeah. Again, I guess that could be positive or negative, hopefully positive. Targeted messaging, depending on, you know, as you walk past a billboard, or depending on your mood, or depending on your thoughts, or it could get quite invasive, couldn't it? But as long as it's used, as you were saying, well, for your purpose, you're talking about improving the user or visitor experience, which would be amazing. Yeah, can you imagine having a different experience as you go through a journey or an event or whatever it is? A different one to your mate who's 10 yards behind you because he's in a different headspace, or she's in a, you know, that would be kind of cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Let's hope. Okay, good. Well, some fantastic answers. Thank you very much for that. We're getting close to the end of our time. Now, I do ask all my guests the same three questions to end the show. So hopefully, Stuart, you've had a think about these questions in advance. So question one, I will start with Russell, so Stuart has time to think. These are easy questions, right? There is no wrong answer here. What's your favourite song, Russell, and why?
So there's not one favourite song, is what I'd have to say, but it's always hard. I've got different favourite songs for different genres, but there's always one that pops up in my head because of what it does when I hear it, right? And it always reminds me of how powerful these triggers are. And I'll get abused for this, but Nickelback, Photograph. Whenever I hear Nickelback, it transports me back to when I was 17 on a college trip to Disneyland for something that, I don't know, we were just messing around. So yeah, it's a nostalgic song for me.
Definitely. Obviously I like music, you can tell from the background, but I don't think there's any wrong answer. And I don't think you should ever be embarrassed by picking, I don't know, whatever is your most embarrassing, whether Kylie happens to be your favorite artist or Nickelback, or it doesn't matter. It's about what, you know, I don't care. Personally, I don't care. There's no snobbery for me with music. It's what it makes you feel. And the fact that you immediately talked about a time in your life and what it made you feel, that is the power of music. That's what is great. It doesn't have to be the greatest song. It doesn't have to be the coolest band. It's you as a 17-year-old having the time of your life. Yeah, I love it. Love the answer. Stuart, what's yours?
I mean, current one is maybe Black Coffee, The Rapture, just a really big house track. And I've loved it, right? When they release the Spotify most played, it's always in that top spot. But interestingly, taking my 18-year-old daughter to Ibiza this year. And he's a resident. So it should be fun. And I think that there's a lovely thing there around a dad that's a bit old that used to party when he was younger and an 18-year-old. And then, you know, we can go and see a resident DJ together. So yeah, that will be good.
That's cool. Is that your first time on Ibiza as well?
No. We used to go when I had hair. a long time ago. But yeah, I've never been clubbing with any of my children. So that will be a first. And I'll probably be in bed by 3 a.m. crying.
Almost definitely. No, that is great. I love that. Because, look, I mean, you just don't know, right? I would not say that you were a house fan, clubbing fan. I happen to make dance music and love dance music as well. So, you know, looking at the two of us, although we're both bald, so maybe that's the common theme. No, that's a great choice. Great choice of artists as well. Thoroughly recommend everyone check him out. Okay, my second question is a favorite book and why? Russell.
I read a book once called The Phoenix Project. And again, it had an impact on me because I could relate a lot to it. And it's going to sound really weird, but the whole book is around fictionalizing the world of IT and a big corporation and all of its problems turned into a story whereby you had a developer that was like, he went on holiday and the business suffered, and you had the CEO that didn't understand what was going on in the business to do with technology. And I read this book and I could just relate with it so much. It was, I'd highly recommend it to anybody that's trying to, just getting into the world of technology and just kind of not reading a textbook that tells you about it, but just as it just put it into a narrative and it put it into this wonderful story of just like, you know, the world is, it's complicated around technology. So yeah, that was good. The Phoenix Project.
That's cool. Yeah. So you are a proper geek, aren't you? Yeah. Even your fiction is geeky, right? Like, love it. Stuart, what's yours?
Paul Arden, It's Not How Good You Are, It's How Good You Want To Be. I mean, that has stayed on my shelf for such a long time. And it's just like really easy to just pick up. And if you're feeling anxious or, you know, you're stress, overworked, so you can just pick it up and it's just, it's a really easy way in, right? It's just, I love how it's like universal truths. I think that's what's great about it. You can just cut through all the nonsense and the quotes that just will carry on. So yeah, that is, it's almost like a life manual that I've had for years that will pick up every now and again.
Sounds like, yeah, I hadn't heard of that actually. So that's a good advice. I'll add it to the pile next to my bed, which is growing after every one of these shows I do. Thank you for that, both of you. Final question, and then you can get on with your day. I don't know whether this applies, but the question is a favorite quote or a saying that you try and live by or remember. Not everyone does, but, you know, sometimes. Russell, would you have an answer to that?
Yes. I don't know who said it or where I heard it, but it, again, stuck with me, to look at things sideways. So whenever we're presented with a challenge or it could be a brief, it could be just anything. It's lateral thinking, I think, is the side of it. But just always to remember, just turn it sideways. What do you see if you just change your perspective?
Yeah, nice. Good advice. Stuart?
Really, really cheesy, but I'm a film lover. There is no tomorrow, Rocky III, Apollo Creed, when he's giving him a wake-up call that if he doesn't train like he should do, then, yeah, he's in all manner of trouble. And cheesy, but relevant, and, you know, seize the day and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Perfect.
Don't judge me. Don't judge me.
There's no judgment here. Thank you very much. That was wonderful. Really nice to speak to you both. Some great books and songs to leave everyone with as well. Thank you very much for your time. I know you're very busy, and thank you for rearranging this when I was a little bit unwell. But fantastic chat. Have a wonderful day. Thank you again.
Appreciate the time. Thanks very much. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Sean.
Cool.
Take care.